I'm Jill Sheridan, in for host Matt Pelser. Today on All In, we're talking about addiction treatment, and this following Side Effects reporter Jake Harper's coverage of an addiction clinic that markets unproven infusion treatments. And joining us today is Jake Harper. Hi, Jake.
Hey, Jill.
So when did you first learn of these treatments that are being offered at this clinic that's called Emerald Neuro Recovery?
Yeah, I first heard about it probably back in 2016, around the time that the clinic opened. Several news outlets did stories on them in 2016 and 2017, and they were mostly positive. So in one story, I remember seeing it even used the word cure to talk about the treatment that this clinic was offering. And I remember thinking, that's weird. Like, how can Emerald claim to treat addiction with such a huge success rate? Wouldn't everyone have heard of this treatment if it were real? But it kind of fell off my radar. The Indy Star did a story about it that was, you know, a little bit more nuanced and talked about the skeptics around it. And I got busy with other things. And then late last year, sort of decided I wanted to look into it and found a lot of disturbing information online, and then also saw that this was something that was happening not just here in Indianapolis or in Carmel, but in other places as well.
Because we know that, you know, addiction treatment and evidence-based methods for addiction treatment has to be very comprehensive with a lot of different elements. And this treatment offered through Emerald is called NAD therapy. Can you explain what that is?
NAD therapy is an IV cocktail. So they stick a needle in your arm and they put some substances into a solution and put that directly into your bloodstream. So one of those substances is called nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. So it's NAD, which is how I will refer to it from now on. So some clinics say they just use NAD, and others say they add other substances like amino acids. But either way, these clinics basically give this IV solution to patients over about 2 weeks, depending on what they're dealing with, and they make really strong claims about what this does in terms of reducing withdrawal and reducing relapse.
And also, other clinics offer this treatment, but for other conditions. Is that right?
Yeah, I think, I mean, even Emerald was advertising it for other conditions. I mean, I saw things from Alzheimer's to Parkinson's to chronic fatigue to anxiety to PTSD. I mean, they offer it for a variety of issues.
And so at this clinic, you know, what do they say? How long does this treatment take? How much does it cost?
So 2 weeks was usually the length of time I was given, 10 to 15 days. For an addiction issue. When I interviewed Emerald, I believe it was $1,200 a day. And then there are additional services that you can add on that cost more as well.
So specifically for addiction, you mentioned, you know, some of the claims that it reduces cravings, that it restores the brain to its pre-addiction state. Are any of these claims proven?
No, they're not. And if you talk to an addiction expert, you know, some of these claims don't even really make sense. So this is complicated. I should just make sure I'm clear. There is one study that a bunch of clinics I looked at tend to point to, but that study was never published in a scientific journal, which is basically the bare minimum of what you need when you're looking at research. It needs to be reviewed by your peers in the science community so that you know that research is valid. And this study that all these clinics are pointing to was not published. And then, you know, looking at what Emerald did specifically, you know, Emerald said at one point it would conduct a study to get more data on NAD therapy. That never materialized. And they also put out a press release at one point saying that NAD therapy had an 87% success rate. I mean, they didn't really define what that meant, for one thing, but they also claimed that information came from Harvard. And I couldn't find any information to verify that claim.
So maybe they're saying that, you know, 87% of their patients are, you know, having success. But in your reporting, you spoke with a family that had treatment at Emerald in late 2016. Can you talk about what their experience was?
Sure. So, yeah, their names were Cheryl was the mother. Jason was her son. He's in his late 30s now, and he's suffered from addiction since he was a teenager. And one of the main substances that he used was benzodiazepines, which can get complicated, which I'll talk about in a second. But Cheryl basically thought that Jason's addiction was going to kill him at some point. And so she saw a TV news story about Emerald and was like, I'm going to call them. And so she and Jason went in to talk to the team there. And she says they basically described it as a cure for Jason's addiction. They said it works for everyone. And Cheryl and Jason kind of waffled about doing it because for them, the amount that they were quoted was $15,000 for this treatment, for 2 weeks of treatment. And that's a lot of money for a lot of people. And so they sort of decided to put it away and not go back. But this clinic kept calling and calling. Emerald just was kind of relentless. And Cheryl eventually gave in, took out an advance on her credit card, and paid for Jason's treatment. And then things got even more complicated. So Jason ended up going into treatment at Emerald. It's an outpatient facility, so he was going in once a day and spending most of the day there. And he couldn't sleep at night. And eventually he started having hallucinations at Emerald. And Cheryl had some back and forth with the company about whether they should go to the hospital or not. Cheryl eventually decided that that was what she wanted to do. And so she went to the ER with Jason, where he started going into seizures, which is a very common problem when you're dealing with benzodiazepine withdrawals. Benzodiazepine withdrawal is really complicated. You can die from it if it's not treated properly. And Jason was basically in the hospital for 4 days, racked up an $11,000 medical bill, and didn't know what else to do. So he went back to Emerald to try to finish the treatment because they were still telling him that it was the right thing to do to finish.
And did he finish the treatment?
He did finish. He says that he never felt any different. And he ended up relapsing a few months later.
So we know other patients, of course, have received this treatment at Emerald. Have we heard of any patient successes?
I never was able to talk to anyone who went through NAD therapy successfully. The company declined to give to connect me with any patient that had been through it. And the people that I ended up finding through my own research all had very similar things to say, that it didn't work for them. Some of them even used the term snake oil, and that, eventually they did relapse.
So the FDA has not approved NAD therapy. How is it that clinics like this one in Carmel are able to market it?
So according to the people that I talked to, they're not supposed to be able to market it, at least the way that they're currently doing. So the one, thing to sort of understand about all this is that if you claim that something treats a condition such as addiction, that by the FDA is considered a medication. And so it needs to be FDA approved. It has to go through three phases of rigorous clinical trials. And the FDA has to, give it the green light to say you can market it like this. You can say this treats this disease. And NAD therapy does not have FDA approval. So the claims that these companies make about treating addiction, according to the people I talk to, are against FDA regulations.
So for people out there who might be looking for an addiction treatment that works and maybe even desperate, how should they inform themselves and what should they be aware of? I mean, can they just educate themselves and do a simple Google search?
If only it were that easy. I think this is a real problem. Before I wrote this piece, if you Googled NAD therapy, most of what you would find was positive news coverage or blogs or clinic websites that tout this therapy as something that's really not proven yet. So you can't just Google this stuff and expect to find solid information. And it also seems like these companies target desperate people and give them information that's not necessarily legitimate. Like, that's what happened to Cheryl and Jason. So I think the easiest way to look at this, I mean, this is so complicated. One of the easiest things you can do is just ask, is this covered by insurance? If insurance isn't covering it, you should really ask why not. And also, are you willing to pay for something out of pocket that may not work?
There are proven ways to treat addiction too, and people can find those ways.
Yeah, I think that's another red flag. If you're talking to a doctor and they don't use buprenorphine, or otherwise known as Suboxone, and they don't use Vivitrol, and they don't use, or they won't refer you to methadone if that's what you need. I mean, those are substances used for opioid addiction. But if they're not using those, that's kind of a red flag to me, because those are the only three medications you can use for opioid addiction that have been approved by the FDA. So if you're offering something as a side treatment to one of those, some of the experts I talked to mentioned that, like, oh, if this were sort of an adjunct treatment to regular addiction, like, maybe it helps somehow. At worst, you're hydrating someone, assuming that substances aren't toxic.
Are there other places that you've heard that are sort of offering, you know, these types of unproven types of therapy for addiction besides this infusion treatment?
This idea of treatments being offered that are not FDA approved, like, this is not new. I mean, this is, it's really been an issue, like, throughout time. Addiction has always been sort of treated differently than other medical conditions. But, there was this therapy called the double chloride of gold that I talked about in my article a little bit, that it made similar claims to what these NAD therapy clinics say, that within days you will be cured of your addiction. It's nothing new. It's definitely something that you have to watch out for. And this is not the only example of that.
Buyer beware. If you want to read Jake's article, you can find it aired nationally on NPR. Thank you, Jake Harper, so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
And we did invite Emerald Neuro Recover to join the show today or be pre-interviewed for All In. They declined to comment. Up next, we'll talk about what comprehensive treatment for addiction looks like and what challenges exist to provide resources to those who need them most. Of course, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. If you've had to sort through fact and fiction while seeking treatment for addiction, let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back in 2 minutes, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. Before we get back to the topic of addiction treatment, I want to tell you about a show that aired last week about requirements for teacher licensing in Indiana. We heard from voices inside and outside of schools on whether these requirements cultivate better educators or only further frustrate teachers being stretched too thin. You can find a podcast of that and all past shows at wfyi.org/allin. You can also find us on Stitcher, which is a free download. Today we're talking about addiction treatment, what works, what is proven, and what sounds too good to be true. As always, we're taking your questions and comments on social media. We especially want to hear from you if you have some personal experience with the issue, and if you're willing to share your thoughts. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I spoke with Dr. Britt Borden, a physician who specializes in addiction medicine, about what the scientific and medical community consider the standard of care when we talk about addiction treatment. Dr. Borden, if I can ask, how long have you been working in addiction medicine?
For 11 years now.
And you do work in Indiana as well in a couple different locations. We're in Indianapolis, and we were talking a moment ago about a therapy called NAD therapy. It's an IV infusion treatment that's not yet proven. One of our reporters here did some work on covering this story, but other clinics have been offering this as a type of addiction treatment. Have you personally ever heard of this type of infusion treatment before for addiction?
Before I read Jake's article, I hadn't heard of this.
It's interesting. You know, when we are trying to outline what is the standard of care for addiction treatment, we want to be careful that we are making sure that people are getting the right information and that they know. So could you outline for us, what does the standard of care look like today for addiction treatment?
The treatment for addiction that I recommend is medication-assisted treatment, as is recommended by SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration. This involves taking medication such as buprenorphine that reduces drug craving and drug use. It also involves monthly counseling visits, the teaching of meditation to reduce anxiety, group treatments in AA or NA, urine drug testing, I also use prescription drug monitoring to make sure the patients aren't getting medications from other doctors. I teach overdose prevention, teaching patients to use naloxone nasal spray to save each other's lives. It's also important to screen for co-occurring disorders such as depression, anxiety, and PTSD, and get patients treatment for that. Another important part of the treatment is screening for infectious diseases such as hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and HIV. And if the patients have any of those, getting them to treatment for those.
So there's a lot of elements that are going into comprehensive care of addiction, and we're learning more about that. What are the components of comprehensive care that science really shows to be successful, that we know we have the research to back up? I know you mentioned MAT, or medication-assisted treatment.
Well, yes. Using buprenorphine to treat opioid addiction has been proven to be effective. And 12-step groups such as AA and NA have also been shown to be effective.
It can be difficult for people to get this kind of comprehensive care. Is that a barrier in states like Indiana?
Sometimes. Sometimes patients have trouble getting to an office. And for patients like this, hopefully telemedicine services may be more available in the future, and that may attract more patients to treatment.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this comprehensive care that we talked about, you know, behavioral health, medication-assisted treatment, this is a widely accepted standard within the medical, most of the medical community right now. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
So what does it mean to have this type of model to help someone who is trying to overcome addiction? And you know, how can providers make sure that, you know, they're providing this type of model?
Well, there are courses doctors can attend to, you know, learn these techniques and to make sure that they're providing everything their patients are going to benefit from. So I would encourage doctors to participate in programs where they can learn these things. In fact, I've heard there's now a Project Echo program for doctors who want to learn to treat opioid addiction with medication-assisted treatment.
Now, for somebody that might be considering a treatment that is not proven and wants to make sure that they, you know, are getting recommended treatment, do you have any advice for people that, you know, could be receiving something that's not proven?
If a patient goes to the SAMHSA website, they'll be able to see what medication-assisted treatment should include. If patients want to learn more about the things I've talked about, they can go to my website, dragonflyrecovery.com, and I outline the things that we've discussed today.
Thank you for taking some time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And in the studio now joining me is Dr. Andy Chambers. Dr. Chambers is a professor of psychiatry at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Dr. Chambers, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be here.
So you heard sort of what Dr. Borden had outlined there as the standard of care, a lot of different elements, medication-assisted treatment, types of therapy. Do you agree with sort of that model and rundown that he provided?
I think he did a great job in the broad strokes of the important elements.
And interesting, too, you know, all the monitoring that comes afterwards. I mean, people might not necessarily understand that that's part of the treatment,
right?
But it is very comprehensive, and a lot of elements need to be involved.
That's right. There are multiple elements, and really these elements should be founded on scientific proof, and not just one test of proof, but several studies by different groups of people who reach a consensus.
And so I know you're familiar with the reporting that Jake Harper did on the NAD therapy, and we're talking about that today. How does the medical community navigate these treatments that are not yet proven? I know that you've also commented on another treatment, which was the bridge, an electronic mm-hmm. device that is said to sort of stop the withdrawal process. Mm-hmm. Again, not yet completely proven by mm-hmm. science. How does the medical community sort of respond to that?
Well, you see a whole host of responses in the medical community. You know, there's a lot of lack of knowledge and expertise in the medical community about any behavioral health condition, about psychiatric conditions, about addictionology. And so I think that we are facing a time where behavioral health care as a whole is seriously lacking, and yet behavioral health care problems are basically driving a major chunk of all medical illness. And so there is a, you know, desperation level out there that not only is in patients but in providers. And so I think one of the many, you know, negative sides of desperation is it causes people to reach because of the desperation, maybe for treatments that are not well proven. And you know, we're kind of in that scene now, especially with the opioid epidemic as it is.
So one of, you know, one of the side effects of having, you know, these treatments could possibly be, you know, actual real conditions. And Jake's reporting the patients that he talked to suffered hallucinations and had to go to the hospital, and he was treated there. But what do we know about the dangers or possibly, you know, concerns involved for addiction treatment without proper medical consultation?
Well, you know, there are several adverse consequences. One is that people, you know, obviously don't do well if a treatment's not effective. They flounder, and there are serious medical and life consequences to, you know, ineffective treatment. That's probably the top of the list. The second is, you know, I think what we have to understand, and this is something all of us will appreciate, is that, you know, a treatment, even there's also an economic part of the equation. And a treatment that's minimally or not effective and yet very expensive is also really you could view that as an unacceptable side effect. You know, expensive treatments that don't have proven scientific benefit are damaging to families. And it's that simple, almost like a health side effect. That's the second issue. The third is a continuation of lack of credibility, a continuation of lack of support for adequate treatment. It kind of perpetuates a skepticism and inappropriate understanding of what are the right standards and what are the wrong standards, and you know, both in the public's mind and the medical community. And so if there's a treatments that don't go along with scientific evidence that are considered normalized for a certain set of illnesses, well, maybe it's because those illnesses aren't actually real either.
And this is a major problem when we're talking about behavioral health and addiction.
Absolutely.
And treating
right.
Correctly.
Right.
You know, speaking of, how do you think that the opioid epidemic has impacted addiction treatment in Indiana? I mean, it seems to me greatly.
Well, we still have a long way to go. I mean, I think that it's really interesting when you think about the roots of the epidemic. Of course, we see in the news that what's happening with Purdue Pharma and their bankruptcy and lawsuits. And, you know, I think that this is really interesting stuff we're seeing happen, but also the roots of the opioid epidemic are very deep and go way up, well beyond misbehavior of pharmaceutical companies. There really are deeper roots. And, you know, the roots of this, again, have to do with, you know, a insufficiency of training among doctors in behavioral health care in general, a lack of treatment infrastructure that has been really collapsing in the United States for decades now, a lack of appropriate insurance coverage. And, you know, what essentially happened with the opioid epidemic, and realizing it's an iatrogenic epidemic, meaning it was actually caused by the healthcare system. One of the origins of this epidemic is you know, a lack of even recognition of the disease of addiction, right? This is part of how it happened, because if you, you know, if you don't recognize the disease of addiction, then you don't have to worry about a side effect of an opioid medication as being addiction. And so this is kind of the setting in which the opioid epidemic has happened. So I think that as we've come around, but, you know, it's unbelievable how slow moving the response has been. I mean, this thing has been going on for over a decade. And the lack of responsivity to it in terms of really getting at the root issues of, you know, changing the way our whole health insurance industry pays for care, behavioral health versus medical, really rethinking about rebuilding infrastructure for behavioral health care, making sure that we're actually training adequate numbers of people, not just, you know, seminars out, you know, when the people are out in practice, because that kind of training tends to be, you know, a little not very deep. I'm talking training that needs to happen at the medical school and residency level when people are earlier in their training and it's a bigger part. So I think that there are, you know, strides, as you mentioned, there are strides that are happening. But in many cases, you know, these strides are kind of, again, the easiest quick fix, kind of the same mentality that got us into this epidemic in the first place, is always pursuing the quick and easy fix and the cheapest fix. And at some point, we have to really go deeper.
Yeah, I mean, that's difficult. I mean, yeah. Those are, you know, major infrastructure changes in the whole health system that that won't happen overnight, obviously.
Right.
But the legislature here has been, you know, attempting to make these changes and have implemented a number of measures we know in recent years. One of those being comprehensive addiction treatment centers.
Yeah.
This past session. Do you think that's a move in the right direction? I mean, to have everything together in one place for an addiction treatment.
It does look like it's a move in the right direction on paper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what you were talking about is something you're very passionate about, you know, the dual diagnosis care, mm-hmm. and the real need for that when we're talking about behavioral health and having the right people in place. I mean, having a shortage of psychiatrists in the state is a real issue.
It is.
And how do we go about, you know, tackling that?
Well, you know, the shortage of psychiatrists, not just psychiatrists, but really every professional in mental health or in behavioral health. I mean, we are short of nurses. We're short of therapists. It's really across the board. But, you know, in terms of shortage of psychiatrists, you know, in some ways, Indiana is a laboratory for this problem because we're really ranked top 48th or 9th in the country, worst per capita ratios. So we kind of really get to see the effects of that. But, you know, it kind of means not only that there's fewer psychiatrists who are available to run inpatient units or run clinics or, you know, treat patients, but there's also fewer of us to consult with our colleagues who are not psychiatrists to help them, you know, at the very least, not cause unintended harm. And, you know, there really is gotten to be a massive abundance of pharmaceutical drugs that has kind of gone out of proportion to the expertise and knowledge base of how to actually prescribe them and make sure that the risk benefits are where they should be. And so you actually see, you know, this is quite routine where you see what we call polypharmacy, where patients are put on way too many psychoactive medications that goes way outstrips the evidence base because you know, there's lots of people who are prescribing these drugs who have never really been trained to diagnose or treat the conditions that these drugs are aimed for, or have not really been taught how to read the literature about how these drugs were developed. And so, you know, the problem is actually much larger than issues around Suboxone.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that, you know, that could, you know, drive us into another
epidemic,
another
show.
It seems like. It's really, you know, important and important work that you're doing. So I hope that you're able to stick around for our final segment, because there's lots of stuff that I didn't get to ask you about this important issue as we're talking about addiction policy here in the state of Indiana. And we do welcome your feedback on Twitter or Facebook. You can find us at All in Indiana. Up next, we'll hear more about addiction treatment from a health policy researcher and learn about continued efforts to increase the number of trained addiction specialists across the state out of IUPUI's Center for Public Health Practice. I'm Jill Sheridan. Back in 2 minutes, this is All In. Welcome back to All In. I'm Jill Sheridan. And joining us again in studio, thanks for sticking around, Dr. Andy Chambers from IU School of Medicine, and by phone today, health policy researcher at the University of Central Florida, Basha Andraka Christou. Did I get that right?
You did. Thank you.
Basha's research focuses on the intersection of health policy and health services. Basha, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
And also in studio today, Andrea Giannata, Program Coordinator, the Center for Public Health Practice at IUPUI. Andrea, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Basha, we've been talking about addiction treatment, of course, and we know that there's a number of medications that are FDA-approved now, medication for nicotine addiction, alcohol addiction, opioid addiction. Can you talk a little bit about what the process looks like for medicine to become certified by the FDA?
Absolutely. So what you're really asking is, how does a medication become approved by the FDA? And it's a long and rigorous process that leads up to that approval. So the approval itself begins when you have a new drug application submitted, and that's about a 10-month review process. So that may not sound very long and rigorous, but in order to even submit that NDA or new drug application, there's a lot of steps that you as a drug manufacturer have to go through. And those include submitting something called an investigative new drug application years before that says, you know, we have some evidence from animal studies, we want to move forward on humans. The FDA looks at that and says, okay, it seems all right to move forward based on what you've shown us in rats or mice. And then they go through three levels of trials on humans. So they start with healthy volunteers. As long as the evidence from that first phase suggests that the medication is safe, then they move on to the next phase where it's larger, it's a randomized controlled trial, and now they're looking at efficacy as compared to either a placebo or to another drug that's on the market. And then if the results from that phase suggest that it is efficacious, and so now we have evidence of both safety and effectiveness or efficacy, then we're moving into the third phase, which is really large and can be up to 3,000 volunteers. And then we're again going to be looking at those two elements again, safety and effectiveness, but now in a much larger context. So across different populations in combination with other medications at different levels of dosages. And then at the end of all of these phases, plus the animal studies that were done at the beginning, this giant package is submitted to the FDA, and then the FDA reviews it and is really looking at two things again, safety and efficacy. And if in the end it finds that the benefits outweigh the risks, then the FDA will approve the medication. So there's a lot that goes in, and really the FDA across the world is considered the gold standard with respect to ensuring safe evidence-based medications. A lot of other countries have intentionally modeled their approval systems off of ours or even defer to ours.
It is very intensive, it sounds like. And so that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, unproven treatments aren't available to somebody up the street. And when you're talking about safety and effectiveness, how is it that we continue to see some of these treatments pop up?
Well, I think a lot of the treatments that have been discussed on the show today, things like injection cocktails of nutrients, I mean, really what you're discussing there are dietary supplements. And dietary supplements are regulated under a completely different scheme. They are not considered medications. They're actually regulated as food. So you don't have to before you grow a tomato, get prior approval to grow that tomato from the FDA. It's after the fact, if there's some kind of problem, you know, people are dying because of something related to that tomato, maybe there's some bad pesticide on it, they'll come after you. But on the front end, there's really not any process to ensure quality, so safety or efficacy. Now, dietary supplement manufacturers have to be very cautious because sometimes they cross that fine line into actually making claims where it sounds like a medication. So if they start to suggest that they're treating or curing or preventing some kind of a disease, then at that point they actually have to go through that entire process that I just discussed for the approval of medications. And if they don't do that, then they're violating all kinds of federal laws. Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, the Federal Trade Commission Act, and there's criminal and civil penalties for that. However, you know, they're not necessarily caught. And the FDA and the FTC, which enforce these rules, don't have the resources, the staff, the money to go after every nutritional supplement or alternative medicine manufacturer that makes claims that they're treating a disease. So, you know, unfortunately, they're left on the shelf still for consumers to buy.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, everybody has probably heard of, you know, some supplement that they feel like they've been told it will do something that they can't really truly believe that it will do, but go ahead and take anyway. You know, this is not new when we're talking about these unsubstantiated claims to medical treatment market. How have we seen, you know, some of these issues dealt with in the past?
Well, so the FDA and the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission and the Food and Drug Administration, they share joint enforcement of false advertising and misleading claims with respect to medications and also nutritional supplements. And unfortunately, like I said, they have limited resources. So they have a range of enforcement tools, but they tend to either, you know, not use them unless it's a very serious risk to health or it's hitting such a large swath of the population that they decide to get involved. Oftentimes, they'll just defer to state authorities instead, who may or may not deal with the issue. But some of the tools they have in their toolbox are on the FDA side, they'll issue warning letters, and those warning letters are basically notice that, you know, hey, if you don't take these steps to correct your actions, then we're going to come after you either with financial penalties or even a misdemeanor or felony investigation and potentially conviction that, you know, could lead to jail time. But in practice, again, it's just a small percentage of the bad actors that are actually getting these enforcement actions. They might, the FDA and FTC could also work with the courts to get an injunction issued, in which case the court will tell the manufacturer, you have to stop making these claims, or you have to withdraw these claims from the internet or wherever they're posted, or maybe you have to correct the claims, maybe you have to add in some qualifying language. Sometimes there's seizures of products that occur. So that's occurred in the past with some nutritional supplements where the FTC or the FDA will work with prosecutors to go in and actually seize the supplements from warehouses and destroy them. So, I mean, like I said, there's a wide range going from the very minimal enforcement of writing a letter that is published online, by the way, so the public can see it, but they're not necessarily looking for it, all the way to, you know, putting the bad actor in jail. But are any of these actions occurring? You know, oftentimes no, because of limited resources.
Can patients, you know, sort of give a kickstart to these actions? Is there anything patients can do to help move this along?
Yeah, absolutely. So probably, unless it's something that is really hitting the whole nation, if it's a more localized issue, maybe a clinic in your state or your city, the best thing to do is to approach the attorney general in your state, and then they can potentially initiate an investigation and work along with the district offices of the FDA and the FTC. If it's at the national level, or if it seems to be crossing state lines, then the FTC or FDA directly might want to get involved. And at that point, even contacting them directly would make sense.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Chambers, I might throw this one to you because this was a question I was unable to ask you, you know, as we're talking about the epidemic here and how people are just at the core really trying to deal with chronic pain. It's a major issue. And Adam on Facebook asks, what about those millions of forgotten people who can't get the help that they need with pain? They're told to take Tylenol. But all the people who care about the ones who are, you know, suffering from addiction, they need help. And they're looking to people who are taking the route of even, you know, as far as suicide to stop this chronic mm-hmm. pain. I mean, this is a big question, obviously,
right.
but are we finding any solutions?
Yeah. Well, so that's a really great question. And one thing just to say as I try to answer it is that, you know, addiction and chronic pain are really not that related. There are many addictive drugs that have nothing to do with pain. They don't relieve pain. They don't produce pain. And, you know, so the intersection of pain and addiction really is in the opioid domain. The thing about pain is that that is a very complex neuropsychiatric phenomenon, and there are many forms of pain. And it is absolutely true and evidence-based and well-proven that opioids have a very important role in certain types of what we call acute pain. And that's been known for hundreds of years. But we also know that there are certain types of pain that not only are opioids not effective for, but opioids actually make it worse. They increase the suffering. And so part of what happened with the opioid epidemic and why Purdue is on the chopping block is because they sort of made the market believe that opioid is the answer for all pain, or at least tried to convey that to professionals and patients, I'm sure. And so I think that the other flip side of this is that there's lots, you know, pain is, again, a very complex, I mean, having major depression, which is a psychiatric disorder, is a type of pain. But we know that, you know, opiates are not a great solution for that. In fact, would make it worse in the long run. There are many, many types of pain with different durations and causes, and it requires many, many types of treatments. And where, again, our healthcare system has fallen down, and this is very complex, you can't really blame, you know, a set of doctors or hospitals or anybody, because the whole system kind of fell down on this, is that for too long, we've decided to, you know, make pain a big issue, and then that the only real solution is, again, the quick fix. The pill, the script that you can write in 5 minutes in a doctor's appointment. And so insurance companies have not really supported other approaches to this much more complex problem other than, again, the quick fix, the sales job, the pill.
Yeah. So I wanted to bring Andrea in, talk a little bit about something that Dr. Borden mentioned when we were talking about comprehensive care and, you know, having people being treated for some of these other conditions that they may end up with, including, you know, hepatitis C. And we know that you're a project, Project Echo, which we've mentioned a couple of times here, you know, to helping to create education lines for providers and primary care providers at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. This particular project that you're involved with is treating hepatitis C for people that do use intravenous drugs and are at an increased risk. How is this project addressing, you know, these issues surrounding addiction?
Yeah, so ECHO is a really phenomenal model in that it brings providers together for training. So it's similar to telemedicine, but rather than having a patient on the other side of the line, it's another provider. So it's that peer-to-peer model. And we use didactics, little brief lectures that are informal that cover some component of care, but coming from an expert. We call it the hub that sits here in Indianapolis. And then our spokes are providers like Dr. Borden, who are all over the state, and they're able to learn from those didactics. And we do case-based learning. And that's really the core of ECHO and where the mastery of skills come in. So it's all de-identified, but we're able to talk about patients that providers are seeing in real time and how would this community of practice help that provider treat the patient.
So how does that help? You know, what does that look like for people in the state of Indiana?
Yeah. I mean, for the patient, there's a huge implication in that you don't have to make a several-hour drive to Indianapolis, wait months on a waiting list. You're able to see the provider in your home community, someone that you know and trust. For the providers, we've seen increases in retention and decreased isolation. So they feel more supported in their work, and they're able to grow their skills. Doctors are really lifelong learners, so this is a wonderful model for them.
Do you see, you know, possibly these projects, Project Echo, and efforts to, you know, inform providers on a greater and wider scale, really helping to sort of change the face of this crisis, the addiction crisis, and just the way that people are treating providing and helping to, you know, make these real connections and rebuild this trust that might have been lost, you know, from these companies.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, like Dr. Chambers said earlier, we need to dig deeper when it comes to the opioid crisis. And I think that interventions like Project Echo make that possible. We're expanding the number of people who can be responsive. Echo is incredibly interdisciplinary. So it's not just doctors. It's kind of all the people who might be part of a healthcare team able to come and learn from each other and understand what's happening in everyone's silo so that we can be really responsive.
I might ask you too, Dr. Chambers, I mean, do you think, you know, we're starting to make any headway rebuilding that public trust in medicine through these types of programs or any way at all?
I think we are. Yeah. I think that Project Echo is an example of it. I think that there, you know, there's at least more attention to addressing, again, the infrastructure and workforce issues and insurance reimbursement. There's definitely been improvements. Just for example, you know, up until 2 years ago, methadone, which is a primary treatment modality for opiate addiction, was not even covered by Indiana Medicaid. One of the few evidence-based treatments that was not allowed to be covered by state insurance. And so that problem was overcome, and that's a bold example of it. But you know, we definitely have a long way to go in this, and but I'm optimistic that things are changing for the better.
Dr. Andrea Christou, I'd like to ask you, you know, looking from the outside in to a state like Indiana, you know, what do you see are some of our challenges as we're moving forward treating addiction in the state?
Well, I think Dr. Chambers did a really great job explaining how there's so many more pieces to the puzzle than just the medications themselves, even though we have really, really strong evidence that the medications like buprenorphine, methadone, naltrexone are important and effective and in fact, can decrease the risk of death from overdose by as much as 50%. But you know, we need a lot more than that. We need detox facilities because even to get on something like naltrexone, you need to go through a complete detox first. A lot of people have trauma. I mean, I would say as a rule, most people have trauma who have a substance use disorder, especially in the criminal justice system. So you need trauma-informed counseling available to go along with the medications. And a lot of these things have not been covered well historically by insurance. So I think that there is momentum beginning, not just in Indiana, but across the U.S. I'm seeing in Florida the same thing towards a more comprehensive coverage mm-hmm. of addiction treatments and not just piecemeal, but it needs to be more integrated and there needs to be alignment between the insurance companies as well as the providers and all the different stakeholders.
Well, we're out of time, but I want to thank you all for coming in today. This is All In. We've been talking about addiction treatments. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Gallen. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. If you'd like to podcast with this show or any of our past shows, you can find it at wfyi.org/all-in. Join us next time when we'll be talking about vaping. Some are calling for a vape ban as health complications continue to rise. You can always send in your thoughts. We'd love to hear from you on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan, and thanks for listening. This is All In.